called having everything go your way.
When you deal with computers, you deal with ones and zeros. And the only way that you can make a computer more powerful is to expand the consciousness of the computer.
Well, it's something bigger than ourselves. And that's got to be said.
That has to do with the self-image that people have.
You know, just kind of your ego being swept aside or being kind of stomped on it or being swatted like a fly.
It really is and truly happening at a societal level.
It is being able to take what feels like ordinary human energy and mastering extraordinary power, even with a single person in a society with this kind of power. Call it the X Factor.
Expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the network, producers, advertisers, or hosts, and belong solely to those who make them. Committed to presenting all aspects of the truth and allowing you, the listener, to decide for yourself.
31 seconds, and we're gone for auto sequence start.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We want to thank you to the show tonight. Welcome to Voice of the Underground with your host, Bravo One. My guest tonight is Mr. Gary Hunt, and the subject he's going to be discussing is We the People. Mr. Hunt, take it over.
Well, we the people, but who are we? You know, it was an interesting question, and it goes back. I'm going to give you a little background on why I wrote this article. I think it might help understand the article more. But 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote an article called Divide and Conquer, and I listed, I think, 42 different patriot groups. I don't know what that was. There was a chat the other night. In fact, a guy said, we're accomplishing something. We got them to outlaw fluoride in Tampa, Florida, I think. Oh, good. That's going to help us restore the Constitution if we get fluoride back. So, Divide and Conquer talks about whether you're Ron Paul supporter, 911 truther, or birth, or anything like that. Is that going to give us the Constitution back? Should our goal be getting the Constitution back or putting out these little fires? And if we put out the little fires, there's going to be another little fire to put out, and we'll spend all our time putting out the fires. So I wrote the Divide and Conquer article, and I think if things work out right, somebody's going to be posting a link to the Divide and Conquer article for you. I don't see them yet. But then about last year, I started thinking, well, you know, that covers some of it, but what is our goal? If it's to restore the Constitution, maybe we need to understand more of what we're restoring.
Right.
We can't just say we're going to restore the Constitution and not know what it means. So look at the diversity in the patriot community, too. You've got militia groups, you've got Tea Party people that are tending more and more towards the hardcore patriots. A lot of things are happening. But is there a common goal? Because people are at odds with each other. And they shouldn't be. So... I started writing an article called Factions, the Chains That Keep Us Apart, the Chains of Oppression. But I realized as I wrote that, and what it focuses on is there's a principal faction, and we'll get into that a little later. But we have to, anybody can have their smaller, lesser factions as long as they adhere to the principal faction. That principal faction is restoration of constitutional government.
Right.
But I realized when I started writing that article that I needed a foundation for that. What is restoration of constitutional government. And so the Constitution begins with we the people. It's an interesting concept. It's one that didn't exist in history before the United States, and to the best of my knowledge, has never recurred in history. At this point, there's only the one instance where a written constitution begins, we the people, where the power of government was granted by the people. And a lot of people will say, well, September 1787, those guys in secret created the Constitution. No, they didn't. They created a piece of paper. And then nine states ratified that piece of paper. Those nine states had conventions of the people. Each area, each district or county or township of that community sent a delegate to these conventions to vote on whether they wanted to ratify the Constitution or not. So it truly was from we the people that the people gave the government the authority to exist.
Right.
That concept has not existed before. Now, that created a nation. Now, that's another question, and I wrote a series of articles called Nations. When you look back in history, words change their meaning over time. We think of a nation as something with a geographic boundary now. Oh, the nation, the United States, that's from Canada to Mexico, the Pacific to the Atlantic, and then let's throw in Alaska and Hawaii. That's the geographic nation. But nations, if we go back in history, that word did not mean the geographic boundaries. That word was really a concept. And within a nation, you had common heritage, common culture, most often a common religion, and a common language. Those elements were necessary to create a nation. In fact, in the early part of this country, there were five nations, Indian nations, and later six nations up in the Northeast. And each of them had a distinct language. They used sign language to communicate between them, or they had interpreters, but they had common heritage, common culture, common religious concepts, and so they had the elements of nation, and there were six of them in that area, and their geographic boundaries varied. You know, they were very irregular. But the concept of nation is one of commonality of the interests of the people. So that we, the people, that created this country, had some commonality. In fact, by 1787, still over half of the people in this country, Indians excluded, were English descent. But we had Dutch, we had Irish, we had Scotch, we had French, we had Spanish, those in lesser amounts except in Florida, Louisiana, and Canada. But we had a merging of a lot of European nations. Now, the common religion was Christianity. Now, popery or Catholicism was frowned upon back then. In fact, Boston celebrated Pope's Day all the way to the beginning of the Revolution. But then a Catholic, Charles Carroll, signed the Declaration of Independence. So there were Catholics here. But there were common elements. The people that came here, for the most part, even the Dutch right away started learning English. They had to get along with the people surrounding New York. And so the common language became English, and it's as it still is. The common culture, basically culturally, most of Europe is pretty much the same. If we take out the religious elements. As far as the heritage that carried through and most of the principles that were embodied in the governments of the time after 1776 when they got rid of the royal governments and embodied in the Constitution had their evolution come from the Anglo-Saxons who went from northern Germany to England, and a lot of the concepts that they brought with them from northern Germany carried through the entire history of England from about 400 AD to 1700s, the 18th century. So we see where all this is coming from. It's coming from Europe, primarily from England. The language is English. So there are the elements, the religion, initially in this country, if you were a Puritan, if you were in a Puritan community and you did something wrong, there's no telling what could happen to you. They could put stones on your chest. They could burn you at the stake. They could drown you. They could put you in stocks or pillories. But that dissolved, and the common religion became basically Christian-based, the recognition of Christ. So we had the elements that made a nation at the founding of this country. So then when I began looking into that concept of a nation in this country and trying to define what we were, I ran across a Supreme Court decision. Now, you've probably heard of it before, but it's called Dred Scott v. Sanford. It was 1856, and the decision was given by Chief Justice Taney. There were some other elements to the case, but in the process of defining who had rights in this country and who did not, Justice Taney tells us a number of things that are rather interesting. For example, in talking about the words people of the United States and citizen are synonymous terms and mean the same thing. They both describe the political body who, according to our Republican institutions, form the sovereignty and who hold the power and conduct of the government through their representatives. They are what we familiarly call the sovereign people, and every citizen is one of these people and constitutes a member of this sovereignty. Now, remember, this is before the 14th Amendment. So at this time, states recognized citizens. There was no official method of doing it. You either were or you weren't. They didn't have bureaucracy. So he goes on and he says, in discussing this question, we must not confound the rights of citizenship, which a state may confer within its own limits, and the rights of citizenship as a member of the Union. It does not by any means follow, because he has all the rights and privileges of a citizen of a state, that he must be a citizen of the United States. Oh, he just said there that you could be a citizen of a state, but the concept of the United States was limited, and we're back to that concept of nation. White, European, Christian were the elements that were recognized at that point in time in our history. This is 60 years after the Constitution. He may have all the rights and privileges of a citizen of a state, and yet is not entitled to rights and privileges of a citizen in any other state. But the Constitution says you have the right to the citizen in the other state. So he's enforcing, again, that limitation that a state cannot confer on somebody a right that's obligatory on another state, because that concept, fundamental concept of a nation, still holds true under the Constitution.
Right.
Nor have the several states surrendered the power of conferring these rights and privileges by adopting the Constitution of the United States. So what they've not transferred anything to the United States that they retain themselves. It's very clear, therefore, that no state can, by any act or law of its own passed since the adoption of the Constitution, introduce a new member into the political community created by the Constitution of the United States. And for the same reason, it cannot introduce any person or description of persons who were not intended to be embraced in this new political family which the Constitution brought into existence, but were intended to be excluded from.
Right.
Now, I don't know if we can get much clearer than that. There's much more in the article, and I think that the article was posted up there. But that's the foundation, that we were a nation then, and there were concepts inherent in that nation, and anything that would undermine that concept, that integrity that's necessary to maintain the stature of a nation, and I'm going to say notwithstanding an amendment to the Constitution, cannot be imposed on this country. Otherwise, this country ceases to exist because its foundation has been ripped out from underneath it.
Right.
So, now, we will be taking questions through the course of this. If you do it on chat, on TFN, we'll try and catch it. If you want to call in, Skype to TFN, Truth Finders Network. I don't know if there's any other way to call in, but it's a complex issue, and I'm not clear. If I'm not clear on something and somebody wants clarification, please ask for it.
Right. If there's a call-in number up here, if people wants to call in on the phone number, it's up the top. Also, you can Skype into it. There is a person there to handle the board and everything. He will accept your calls. If he's not there right now, he will be there in just a few minutes because he was out taking a break, giving us a few minutes to get started before he actually started taking calls. But he should be there about any time taking the calls again.
Okay, now Tanny goes on in the case, and now he goes to the Declaration of Independence. Now, I'm just quoting some of what he said in the case. There are many pages in that decision that address this, and the really pertinent ones are included in the article. But when he gets to the Declaration of Independence, he says it begins by declaring that when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Now, for one people. So, the Declaration of Independence even recognized that we were one people. That was that nation that was created by these 13 colonies united under a confederation.
Right.
It then proceeds to say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, the concept of consent of the governed predates the Declaration of Independence. It goes back in English history because a lot of the revolutions in England had to do with the Parliament or the King taking powers that they should not have based on the Magna Carta and subsequent actions. But this is the first time now where the entire consent, the government exists because of the consent of the government. But he says all men are created equal. Then he says, the general words above quoted would seem to embrace the whole human family. And if they were used in a similar instrument at this day, would be so understood. But it is clear for dispute that the enslaved African race were not intended to be included and form no part of the people who framed and adopted this declaration. For if the language, as understood in that day, would embrace them, the conduct of the distinguished men who framed the Declaration of Independence would have been utterly and flagrantly inconsistent with the principles they asserted, and instead of the sympathy of mankind to which they so confidently appealed, they would have deserved and received universal rebuke and reprobation. Now, what he's saying there is, even in Europe, there was no way in hell that somebody from Africa or China would ever be recognized as being an equal with them in the European turf. And so when the Constitution was recreated, there was a definite exclusion to retain that concept of nation that is absolutely necessary. Now, we've seen the denigration of the concept in many forms. One is, hey, the exercise of Christmas, or saying prayer in school, or at a football game, you can say something Muslim or something other ways, but you can't say Christian things. But that is so fundamental to the concept of nation. So that's an indication of the efforts that are being carried out to tear apart the concept of nation and make it a geographic entity that comes under the absolute and complete control of those in power in Washington or wherever the power might evolve from later on.
Right.
Like the United Nations or something like that.
Okay,
so the concept that the traditions and all this has to be carried through and consistent without change, because once you change it, it starts stretching and pulling. And I'll give you an example of that. Since the beginning of this country, there have been problems involving Negroes and white people.
Correct.
Whenever and something gets them to try and change that, the problem becomes worse, manifestly worse. The Civil War, the number of people that died. Look what happened. We had the civil rights in the 1950s and 60s, and look what's happened since then. We cannot change that fundamental concept. Now, I'm not saying that other people that aren't part of the We the People, and this is where factions comes in, that aren't a part of We the People have no rights in this country, like Tanny said. Tanny said it then. Times have changed. But let's go back to the Anglo-Saxons. The Anglo-Saxons had three classes of people. They had citizens, and they had kind of second-class citizens, and then they had non-citizens. The citizens were the Anglo-Saxons. They owned land. They were the merchants, the people building the communities. The almost citizens, the second-class citizens, were people similarly situated but that had not achieved as much in life. And whether I still don't know that whether they could ascend to citizenship or if they could marry into full citizenship, earn it, or anything else. But they were given the rights, but they weren't given a lot of the authority the citizens had. And finally, we had those non-citizens. They had rights, too, and they were protected by the laws of the land, but their rights were minimal.
Right.
Now, England had two classes of citizen at one time, or subjects. Most countries in the world have gone through a structured phase. India had seven or eight classes of people. But there's nothing wrong with having a principal citizen and a second-class citizen. It doesn't make them second-class. What it says is they are not in a position to effect a change in the principles of this country, the We the People principles, because if it allowed that, if it allowed for that to happen, all they have to do is get a majority, and all of a sudden, the United States, as embodied in the Constitution, as fought for two centuries, ceases to exist. It's been taken over by subversive means, by introduction of people that are not consistent, they're not adapted to the principles upon which the nation was founded. Now, do we see that happening today?
Yes.
Especially,
we see a lot of changes.
Yeah, right. And one of them is the vote. What happens when the majority becomes Mexicans, for example, illegal Mexicans? That means they can get an illegal Mexican as the mayor of Los Angeles. Now Los Angeles becomes a part of Mexico. And is that... I'm going to be a little unpolitically correct right now. When their propagation is akin to rabbits, they will become the majority in a short period of time wherever they go. So that simple process of one being constrained in their reproduction and the other being vociferous in their reproduction is the means of basically a revolution, because you throw the old government out and put a new one in based on principles that came from south of the border up to here. Now, if that's what we want, we continue on the path we're on now. I don't think that's our future. I think it is if we don't do something about it. Let me put it that way.
There's going to have to be a lot of changes made. We need to go back to our Constitution. We need to figure out who our citizens are, who should be our citizens, who should be allowed here, who should not be allowed here. If we're going to allow other people to come over, there should be a situation set for them. The thing of it is, right now, look what's happened by us allowing a lot of different people to come over here that's never even become citizens and doesn't really want to become citizens except to change it over to their ways. You know, that's
right.
You know, different. It's different when you've got people that's lived here and they're really trying to become a citizen, like some of the Irish people did when they came over and stuff like that. You know, that's a little bit different. They really wanted to be citizens. They really wanted to be free. So if they want to conform to our government, and if they are not our government, if they want to conform to the way we set up our nation and our country, then, you know, yes. But if they want to come over here and start changing the system and changing the rules and changing the laws, no, because that's what's got us into this position we're in now.
Well, there's a concept called assimilation that was practiced. It started all the way through the 50s, it was true, and then it started changing with the civil rights movement broadening up, and by the 90s, it became ludicrous because the first amnesty came in 1994, 95, 96, somewhere along there, where if you'd been illegally in this country for 5 years, I think, then you could stay here, but if you hadn't been breaking the law as long, you had to go back to Mexico. But the concept that exists in this country, now I'm not sure when immigration policies were imposed. States could remove people, not allow them in. There was nothing formal, even though the Constitution gave the federal government the right to naturalization and immigration. They never really did very much with it, but eventually they started establishing quotas. There were requirements. You had to have a certain amount of education or a trade. You had to have a clean record. And they also had quotas from various countries to keep the mix being what it is. And for the most part, 99% of those were European countries. Other countries might be allowed under certain conditions, but otherwise, other countries were prohibited from immigrating to this country. And the people that came over then, and in my lifetime, I've met some that, you know, I knew people that were born in the 1800s, and in foreign countries, and they came here to assimilate. They wanted to be Americans. Their goal in coming here was to reap the benefits they got from being an American, which was the right to work and make a living, not to have it handed to you. They wanted to become Americans. The first thing they did when they, except for, and you see this a lot, the older women did not want to learn English. But the older men and the younger people all wanted to learn English. Their first objective when they got here, and they had to learn English to become a citizen. And they had to wait 7 years to become a citizen. And they had to read portions of the Constitution. But they wanted to learn English. They wanted to assimilate. It doesn't mean they gave up their past, because there's Irish-American clubs, there's German-American clubs, there's Italian-American clubs all over this country. They were very common back then, because they could go back and kind of live the past, but their Italian heritage stayed in that building. And when they left that building, they were Americans. They wanted to be Americans. They assimilated. They became a part of that nation, the United States of America, by their backs.
They wanted to be free. They didn't want to be pushed around. They wanted to be able to do basically what they wanted to do. They didn't want to change this country. They liked this country the way it was. That's the reason why they came over here.
Yeah, it was something they weren't liking back then, too.
Right. There was nothing here anymore. You know, and everything that we did have, the so-called tyrant government has taken away from us.
Right. End of World War II, income taxes, 4%. Now, at the end of World War II, I think they went up to 10% to pay the debt. Before World War II, the maximum income tax was 4%, and it only applied to a very small percentage of the people in this country. 4%. Hey, I wouldn't mind paying it if it was 4%. But now it's what, 30%? That's why I haven't paid it in almost 30 years now. 28 years I haven't paid income tax. That's too much. Every 3 years you give one paycheck to them.
Right.
That's not counting all the other little taxes.
Well, it used to be in everything when you got a piece of land that belonged to you. You didn't have to pay on it even after you paid for it. Now you have to keep paying on it every year or they take it away from you.
Well, there were not quite true. There were always ad valorem taxes, and ad valorem taxes go back, they had a purpose. They go back to colonial days. At least in the I think it was the Chesapeake Bay, one of the bays, they set up a school, and they paid the school teacher, they built the schoolhouse, they arranged for the books, which were Bibles then, by the way, but they paid the school teacher in fish. They were fishermen. They paid the school teacher in fish. Now, the concept of public education is predicated on, and see, here's another place where we've gone awry. Was based on the local community will contribute to support the public school system. The more they're willing to contribute, the better their education their children will get. That's an interesting concept. It works, too. Now, So through the first two centuries of this country, for a century and a half of this country, there were a lot of different types of schools, but there were a lot of initially there were they had subscribers, people that charitably contributed to these school organizations, what they called free schools. But then the concept, Jefferson's concept of public education began to catch on, and in the western lands, actually section 16, 1 square mile out of 36 square miles was given to schools for education. So the public education was there, and the ad valorem taxes were relatively small, because if you got 300 families and all they have to do is provide a place for the school teacher to live and make sure she can eat or he can eat, it's not going to cost very much. It might cost a couple bushels of corn, a couple chickens, maybe eggs all year long, something like that. Very small amount, because there wasn't much cash. But if it was cash, it would still have been relatively small, because you got 300 families supporting one person.
Yeah.
But wait, now we've got half the people in this country being supported by the damn government. More than half, if you count the employees and the entitlement people.
Yeah,
but back then, it was 300 families for one person.
Well, see, the thing of it is, the government, the tyrant of government, has created a lot of this problem, because they've done away with the tax. They've put the taxes on these businesses so hard and everything that a lot of the mom-and-pop businesses had to go out of business. A lot of the small businesses had to go out of business. The only ones that's there now is the corporations that's out there. Most of the factories is gone. They went overseas. The only places around here now is places like Walmart and stuff like that. And we know who owns most of them kind of places. You know, they could care less about us. They're going to get us in there working a little bit of nothing. And if you look around and everything, Walmart has killed a lot of local businesses. There's been certain towns that has not allowed Walmart to come into them just because of that reason. Because when they move into a town, most mom-and-pop organizations ends up having to close.
Well, it's interesting, though, because Wickenburg, Arizona denied Walmart coming into their community. Or yeah. Was it Costco? Costco, I guess it was. Walmart or Costco, one of those. But it was one of the wholesale type things. They built it in Sun City, which is 25 miles down the road. But people from Wickenburg, as soon as it was built, started driving the 25 miles because they saved so much money. And there was one hardware store in Wickenburg that I used to go to. This guy would go down to Walmart or Costco sometimes and buy things there, come back and sell them at his price in his store. So it became his wholesaler. Walmart has changed the way we market, and I can't say if it's good or bad. It is destructive of small business because they have a buying power that I think is unfair, but that gets back to some other problems in the country. Let's go back to education, though. What happened that we started thinking that public belongs to the government and all people are created equal means everybody's equal no matter what? This began in 1953, when under Eisenhower administration, the Department of Education was created. It's since become the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. But it was just education back then. There was no national welfare. There was no national health care system. Before that, the local school district raised the money through ad valorem taxes. The only place that money went back then, the 30s and back then, was to the school. And it was voted on by the people. In fact, there's a article I've got up. It's a book. It's called Elements of Civil Government. Maybe my assistant can find that and put it up. Elements of Civil Government. It's from 1891. But the school board then was elected by the people. They determined determined how much they were going to contribute to support the school. And the more they paid, the better the teacher. The less they paid, the worse the teacher. But they knew that, and it was based on the economy of the community. The school board then determined who the teacher was going to be. They would arrange to have a schoolhouse built. They would decide the curriculum and what books would be used, which could include the Bible at that time. So the community decided what education they were going to get. Now, over time, and I'm not sure it varies from state to state, the state started getting involved in this stuff. They started having incorporated or unified school districts when I was a kid, and these were controlled by the state. They still had the parents' teachers' associations when I was a kid, and they could have an effect. They could tell the school board, don't do that. The school board most often would listen to the parent-teacher association.
Right.
But now it's come to the federal government controls education, so this is propaganda. They control what our children learn. They control that all men are created equal means everybody. It doesn't mean what it meant then. They have changed the meaning. They have changed what public means. Public means it belongs to the government. We own it. Screw you. They have made so many changes. It's unbelievable. In fact, we're at the point now that they don't educate you in school. When I was in school, they taught you things, and they taught you how to learn. Now they don't teach you anything except how to pass the exam at the end of the year. That's not based on the education. It's based on how well the teachers did in teaching you this very small set of objectives.
Right.
So American history has gone by the wayside. The honest history of this country, our traditions, our heritage, all this important stuff that we should all know has gone by the wayside because the federal government has taken over absolutely the education of our children unless you homeschool. And this includes charter schools because they're limited on what they can do. They still have to stay within federal constraints. A lot of states have imposed rigid restrictions on homeschooling as well. That you have
right.
to use their curriculum and all this. Now, I don't care what they say. My 18-year-old daughters, the twins, have never been to a public school in their life, and they're probably smarter than most 18-year-old students out there because they have gotten a good education based on available homeschool support groups and resources that are available. They're not conditioned by the government. But that,
yeah.
you know, what Hitler tried to do with Hitler Youth, the United States government has achieved, absolutely. And that's why we run into a problem dealing with the concepts that we're talking about now in We the People, but who are we the people?
Right. But that's something that I've said on here several times and told different people. If they want to know exactly what's going on, read Hitler's Mein Kampf. They'll know exactly what's going on because that's their playbook. That's what they're going by. They're going just by exactly, like you said, like Hitler Youth and stuff like that. They're following it to a T.
Right. They've done better than Hitler ever did.
Yeah.
Talk for a minute, Bravo. I'm getting a link right now.
Okay. One of the worst things that we've got going is, like Gary said, They're not going by what the Constitution naturally says. They're adding words to it, or they're changing words. They're not necessarily changing the words and stuff like that. They're changing the meanings of the words. And that's what's destroying our country. They're making things sound the way they want them to sound. They're doing things the way they want them to do. The last few times that I've heard them talking about it, they don't even go by the Constitution anymore. That's just a history paper. That's just something that was and is not now. They've said that several times. What's the use in going by it? They don't think it's in force anymore. They say it's not in force. We don't go by the Constitution anymore. We go by their laws, their rules, the way they do things. And like one of our so-called tyrants is in high places said, we're not going to do it unless it's okay with the UN. We're going to get our orders from the UN. So that tells us right there that what Gary's saying is true, that the Constitution, basically, in the eyes of the tyrants in government right now, is non-existent. They're not going to go by it. And if they do go by it, if they do bring it up into a subject, they're going to take their words and change them into what they say the meaning is, not what the meaning was originally intended for.
Right. That's exactly what's happening. And somebody made a comment when I was on the chat, and let me read you this. This is an 1787. Now, in 1776, the colonies were told to create a constitution, create a new government, with the exception of Rhode Island and Connecticut. Everybody did. those two states retained their charters, but they removed reference to the king, the royal, and to the parliament, and made their own general assemblies the legislative bodies. North Carolina had adopted a constitution, and one of the elements in that constitution is no property shall be taken without due process of law, one that carried over that same year into the Constitution, which was ratified 2 years later. A Tory had come, had their, during the Revolution, a Tory's land had been taken from them. They got back, and the legislature passed a law that said a Tory has no right to go to court to attempt to reclaim their land. But the Constitution said land, property can't be taken without due process. So the North Carolina Supreme Court, in a case called Baird versus Singleton, 1 North Carolina 42, 1787 was the year, said, but that it was clear that no act that they, meaning the legislature, could pass, could by any means repeal or alter the Constitution. Because if they could do this, they would at the same instant of time destroy their own existence as a legislature and dissolve the government thereby established.
Right.
So if they pass a law that's unconstitutional, they have destroyed their own existence, and they have dissolved the government created under them.
Well, they've been doing that right and left here lately.
Right, but that concept was embodied in the Declaration of Independence, and it came, the earliest I found where that concept came from was a guy named John Locke, second treatise or two treatises of government, chapter 19, when he talks about dissolution of government, and that can be found in my article Sons of Liberty 14. That's what you look for, Cav. Sons of Liberty 14.
See,
and but the concept is quite simple, that when we, if the people create a government, Locke was quite a bit ahead of the United States. If the people create a government, what they've done is they've created a compact or a charter or a constitution. That document creates the government by the authority of the people. But in essence, it's a contract. And that contract says, just like the law of agency, if I hire you as an agent and I said, this is the limit of your power, and you go beyond that limit, you take the liability. Though I might be financially liable, I have recourse to you because you violated the contract. I can terminate you anything when you exceed that authority. That's what the Declaration was all about. It was a dissolution of government. So what Locke said is when the government breaches the contract, they have divested us from any obligation to that government. We have removed ourselves. We have been removed by the government's action into what's called, defined back then, as a state of nature. Now, I'm in a state of nature. I'm in Rome. I got to do as the Romans. But I'm in a state of nature as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't consider voting because that system is so corrupt. And if I vote, I agree with it. Once I go down and vote, I have agreed to the government that's there, and I haven't agreed with that government for 28 years. And I have no intention of agreeing with them and abiding by them except by force. There's Sons of Liberty 14 that talks about this dissolution of government.
When I came back from the service in 77, when I was done with the service after I'd done my time overseas and everything, and I finally got home for my last time and done my last jumps and stuff like that, and I got out of the service, I was done with the government at that point in time. So, you know, I've had no use for them ever since then because of the way we was treated when we went over there and the way we was treated when we got home. I've had no use for them whatsoever, and I'm sure there's several others on here tonight that has been through the same things, knows exactly what I'm talking about, and I know they haven't been going by it either. You know, we just been, like you said, when in Rome you have to do like the Romans do. It's time for the end of Rome.
Mm-hmm. Just about a matter of how much you're willing to stand up against them and say, screw you, I ain't going to do it.
Right.
And yes, and everybody, again, Carl Klang, a lot of you that have been around a long time might know Carl Klang or who he is, what he His first song, the big one, was 17 Little Children back in the Waco days. Here comes martial law, the Federal Reserve ain't federal at all. He wrote a whole bunch of songs back in the early and mid-90s that were, you know, he was the songster for the Patriot community back then. And when I was up in Washington, I met Sonny Klang, his wife. Carl was at work that day, and Sonny and I were talking, and she very apologetically said, I've got to admit, Carl pays we pay our taxes. And, you know, this is true. I told her that's not a problem. We had been talking taxes, and I told her I didn't pay them. And I said, "That's you know, I see no problem with that. Carl's job is to write and sing that music, and he does a wonderful job at it. And he doesn't need to bring shit down upon your whole family by not paying taxes out of principle when he's doing the job that he's opted to do, which is to write these songs and sing them, that we each have the role that we're going to play in this community. Mine has been to challenge the Internal Revenue Service and things like that. So I take that, that's what I do. But all of us have to find some commitment somewhere that will help us get back to constitutional government, whatever it is, and don't feel bad if you're paying your taxes to keep the tax collectors, the IRS, out of your house. Do what you have to do to get back to constitutional government. But understand that state of nature is where you are, and you're accommodating Rome because it's safer. I drove without a license. I proved that you could do it. Now I use a license to drive. I proved it, but it's a hassle. It takes time going to court. It wastes too much of my time to keep driving without a license. But the time I was charged with driving out without a license and without tags on my motorcycle, I beat the case. So I'm satisfied that I don't need a license, but I'm not willing to commit the amount of time that I spent fighting that to win it when I can be doing other things with that time.
Right. Well, that's the way with a lot of us. A lot of us, you know, we've stopped doing a lot of different things, but what we're trying to accomplish and everything, that if we do the things that we actually want to do, it would take up so much of our time that we wouldn't have time to pay attention to what's really going on around us. You know, because that's like you said, that devotes too much time to that area when there's so much and so many other things that needs to be done.
Okay, now let's go back to the subject. We'll get back on point for a minute. James Madison in Federalist Papers 62 said something rather interesting. It poisons the blessings of liberty itself. It will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood. If they be repealed or revised before they are promulgated and undergo such incessant changes that no man who knows what the law is today can guess what it will be tomorrow. Law is defined to be a rule of action, but how can that be a rule which is little known and less fixed? Now, that's an interesting concept. Laws can't change. They have to be in accordance with the Constitution. If they're not, they fall under what North Carolina said. The government ceases.
Right. And there's been a lot of them laws and everything like that. You know, because, well, look at how they've done with the drugs and stuff like that, and they're still fighting that battle. Years ago, they could be picked up just about anywhere. Nobody said anything about them. Okay, now I'm not saying to return the drug deal and everything like that. What I'm saying is that if they was to legalize it and do something with it instead of doing the way they're doing, there would be a lot less people out here dying over bad drug deals. Okay,
right.
There would be a lot less criminal activity coming across the borders and in our streets than what we have now. They ran into the same problem, and I don't know why they didn't figure this out when they made alcohol illegal.
That took a constitutional amendment, though.
Yeah, but if you look at the war that they got themselves into. They got into a war that they couldn't handle. So they ended up
the gangsters so powerful that they continued with their impact on society to today, almost.
Right. See, they've created that by doing that. They made the alcohol legal again, made it to where you had to be a certain age to get it and stuff like that. Same way with cigarettes. They made them they're legal and everything, or was legal. They're trying to do away with that. But then they made it to where you had to be a certain age to buy them, which that wasn't a bad idea. I agree with that. Maybe if they'd have done that back when I was younger, I wouldn't be smoking today. But still on the same concept, by doing those things and finding that out about the alcohol and stuff, they turned right around and done the same thing against drugs and made it even worse than what the alcohol deal was. You know, why didn't they legalize it to make a certain age where they had to come get it? Because they know them people was going to get it anyway.
My grandfather had a saying when I was young, and he died when I was still a teenager, but one of my grandfathers, but he had a saying, he said, each man has a right to his own poison.
Right.
Now, if we are a free country, where in the Constitution did we give the government the authority to say that something that God gave us, they can take away from us?
That's very true.
Now, you said legalize. I say decriminalize. There should be no criminal laws. Now, with alcohol, as was true early in our history, the Whiskey Rebellion and all that, those that make it can be taxed under the excise tax, but the government then had to pay off the debt they'd incurred during the Revolution. And it seemed that the pleasure of alcohol was a means of letting people that wanted that pleasure of alcohol be one of the elements that helped pay that debt. What they didn't take into consideration, however, was the taxes had to be paid in specie, and there was no specie in western Pennsylvania, specie being gold and silver coin.
Right.
There was no specie there, so the Whiskey Rebellion actually came because there wasn't enough money to pay the debt, and it was ironic that the Congress didn't realize that because they'd gone through the same thing just a decade before then when with the taxes, the stamp tax, and all these taxes that England was imposing, they had to be paid in specie as well, which drained all the silver and gold out of this country and forced the colonies then to issue paper money, fiat currency like we have today, which created a lot of the economic problems that existed at the time. So the intention to do good by Parliament and the intention to do good by the Congress in assessing taxes, demanding specie payment when there's no specie, was destructive, counterproductive. It was not thought out. Now, what's not thought out today, like the Prohibition and all these other laws, is the consequences. They don't think of those things. These guys are supposed to be intelligent, and they seem pretty damn stupid. We've sent hundreds of millions of dollars American dollars is stored in closets in Mexico because we created a war without an enemy.
Yeah.
The enemy became us. The benefactor became Mexico.
Right. Well, you know, the UN put out here a couple of years ago, and I think the president even announced it, that we had lost the war on drugs. And they come up with, the UN came up with something for us to go by and everything to stop that war on drugs. But the government never took that up, even though they're listening to the UN on everything. They never took that up. So they just dug themselves in deeper, is what they done. You know, somebody says, hey, look, you can't do that. If you do it this way, you're going to stop that problem. You're not going to have that war. But they didn't do that. They even pushed it farther by selling or giving guns to the Contrail in Fast and Furious. They just made it worse. They didn't make it any better. They just made it worse. And that's all they've done this last few years, is anything that any suggestions that anybody gives them or tries to help them with, they go against, and then they get yourself in even more hot water. It's like it's actually trying to destroy everything.
They are, and they're undermining the concept of nation, too, by taking away our natural rights.
Yeah.
Remember, the Constitution, the enumerated rights aren't all. The Ninth Amendment says the rights not enumerated, and the right to use the gifts from God, whether it be alcohol or marijuana or anything else. Remember when Prohibition passed, you could go down to the corner drugstore without a prescription and buy cocaine or marijuana. But they outlawed alcohol.
Yeah. Well, you used to buy Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Before they changed it. That was cocaine.
Yeah, and Coca-Cola now claims that it wasn't, but I think there's pretty good evidence that it did have. That's why it was the pause that refreshed.
Yeah, because, see, it was actually designed, and maybe they want to get away from it, but it was actually designed as a medicine. It wasn't designed as a soft drink.
Well, yeah, and opium was, too. I'm reading a book right now talking about the drugs and the problems getting drugs during the Revolutionary War, the difficulty. A lot of what was in Boston was actually, when British took over Boston, when they left, they put arsenic in all these other medicines, and they started giving them out. People started getting sick and dying, and they realized that the British, when they left, the drugs they didn't take, or at least in this one warehouse, they put arsenic in everything. So we had a hell of a time getting the drugs that were available then, but opium was a common one. It was a pain reliever. Now, right. If I had a choice of opium and oxycodone for pain relief, I would go with the opium. I don't like the consequences of these chemical drugs.
Right. These synthetic drugs that's what's killing us.
Right. But what they've done is, what these laboratories do is they find a way of synthetically creating what God created. Aspirin is from the bark, made from the bark of a birch tree. And they haven't been able to get rid of that one, but they have ibuprofen and these others now. The natural occurring drugs, codeine, cocaine, opium, things like that God gave us, what they want to do is they want to make a chemical replacement for it and then outlaw the original so that you have to buy from the pharmaceutical companies regardless of the consequences to your health.
Right.
Now, that's government in the pocket of the pharmaceutical companies, and that's not the only people that have the government in their pocket.
Right.
So anyway, back to We the People. Let's see where we go next. There was the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1867, was it? And the 15th Amendment shortly thereafter. Now, the 14th Amendment reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law." Well, that's kind of interesting. I'm going to go back to the beginning of that. All persons born or naturalized in the United States, and here's the kicker, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Now, who was subject to the jurisdiction thereof at that time?
Basically, English and stuff that signed the Constitution and...
No. Anybody else, yes. Anybody else, yes.
Okay.
But not the state citizens. Now, it might not be clear, but being subject to the jurisdiction thereof. I've got some other cases, and they're not in the article, and I don't want to go there, but I'm going to go to one called Twining versus State. This is a New Jersey case. And this is 1913, if I remember correctly. I got to find it. Twining, come on. Twining versus State of New Jersey, 1908 case, United States Supreme Court. Now, Twining and Cornell, the two petitioners to the United States Supreme Court, had indicated that they were citizens of New Jersey.
Okay.
So the court said, whether such a law, state law, violates the 14th Amendment, either by abridging the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States or depriving persons of their life, liberty, or property without due process of law, in order to bring themselves within the protection of the Constitution, it is incumbent on the defendants to prove two propositions. First, that exemption from compulsory self-incrimination is guaranteed by the federal Constitution against impairment by the state. And second, if so guaranteed, that the exemption was in fact impaired in the case at bar. The first proposition naturally presents itself for earlier consideration. If the right here asserted is not a federal right, that is the end of the case. Okay. We have no authority to go further and determine whether the state court has erred in their interpretation of enforcement of its own laws. Now, what he said was, since these guys had declared themselves state citizens at trial, that they were not federal citizens, or what we commonly refer to now as U.S. citizens, therefore, the protections afforded by the 14th Amendment did not apply to them. So in 1913, the Supreme Court recognized that there are federal citizens, and there are state citizens, and then there are people that are both federal and state citizens. But Cornell and Twining were state citizens, not federal citizens. Now, obviously, jurisdiction did not apply to them, or they would have been federal and state citizens according to the 14th Amendment. So that kind of proves of the exclusion that if I had a right to be here, if I had the fundamental rights, the Constitution didn't operate on me. However, if I'm a visitor from a foreign country, I'm subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. If I'm a recently freed slave, freed by the 13th Amendment, the second 13th Amendment, then what authority do I come under? The state doesn't recognize me, especially the southern states don't recognize me, so I have to be subject to federal jurisdiction because the state doesn't recognize me. So the recently freed slaves were subject to federal jurisdiction. People that came from foreign countries visiting were subject to federal jurisdiction. So people were subject to federal jurisdiction if they were outside of that concept of we the people that Taney talked about in Dred Scott v. Sanford. The people that were of we the people were not subject to federal jurisdiction. Now, I have, like I say, I've got other cases. I have a case from early 1800s where another one similar to the North Carolina one, but it was United States Supreme Court, where a guy in Baltimore said that when they diverted the water from his dock, he could no longer bring ships into his dock, and they took his property without due process as guaranteed by the Constitution. The court said, we don't have jurisdiction. The federal Constitution is for the federal the general government. It's not for the state government. So a distinction was set early on that there are two separate and distinct jurisdictions.
Right.
And so the federal Constitution did not apply. It did not protect this guy in Baltimore, Maryland, from the state, because as they said in the court decision, the people of the state, in making their constitution, decide what their that government's powers and authorities and limitations are. The Constitution for the United States of America was simply to give the powers, the authorities, and the limitations on the general government, the federal government. They called it the general government then. So you had two separate and distinct bodies that can't overlap each other. Okay. Now, if I'm both citizens, I guess they could overlap. I'm not sure, but I'm a state citizen. I'm a citizen of Florida. I've declared that. It's on record there. And I am not a United States citizen. And I hold that position. I'm in a state of nature. I'm residing in California now, but I'm a citizen of Florida and not a U.S. citizen, which creates a dilemma for the Internal Revenue Service. They don't know what to do with it, along with some other things. And I don't want to go into advocating you not pay your taxes unless you learn how you get by with not paying your taxes properly. And if I start teaching that, then I'm going to be shot at for any number of reasons by the government.
Right.
And I think that goes back to something we've talked about in Vortex, the Internal Revenue Service that use state law, local law, or anything else to get these people out of the way. And so what you've done is become a turkey and stuck your head up above the log if you start teaching people how not to pay income tax. And I don't want to do that any more than Carl Klang wanted to not pay his taxes. So anyway, there's a very definitely in the Supreme Court decisions a distinction. The court also said that the 14th Amendment withdrew from the states powers theretofore enjoyed by them to an extent not yet fully ascertained, or rather, to speak more accurately, limited those powers and restrained their exercise. There is no doubt of the duty of this court to enforce the limitations and restraints whenever they exist, but there has been no hesitation in the performance of that duty. But whenever a new limitation or restriction is declared, it's a matter of grave import, since to that extent it diminishes the authority of the state, so necessary to the perpetuity of our dual form of government, and changes its relation to its people and to the union. So what he said is, since Maryland had not passed a law that said you can't take public property without just compensation, which he was trying to get, since they didn't have that law, the federal government doesn't have the right to come in and change the relationship of Maryland to the people of Maryland.
Ah, okay.
Okay? So slowly, I mean, you know, if you read the whole article, I think you'll get more out of it. I'm just kind of skimming through it. But the concept is there. And if you look deep enough, it is there. It's really there. That if you're a state citizen, you're not subject to federal jurisdiction. You know, people have wondered why Gary Hunt must be a government agent. Look at how he writes and look at all the things he does, and he's never been arrested by the government. Well, maybe the government knows that they can't arrest me. I hope so. I've been kind of relying on that, but I'm still always a little apprehensive.
Right. Well, they kind of do anything they want to now, so it's hard to tell.
Well, no, I think they have to stay within their limits, and it's, you know, my newest project has to do with law, and I haven't dealt with law for over 20 years, but something happened recently that's got me looking into something called habeas corpus. Anybody know what habeas corpus is?
I don't see nobody answering.
I don't either. Habeas corpus is an interesting concept, and so let me find what it means.
It means body of the crime, or
well, that's a Latin. That's what they teach us in government schools. Yes, the body of the case.
Right.
Let's go back and look what habeas corpus meant. There are 8 habeas corpuses in Black's Law Dictionary, but only one of those is the sacred writ.
Okay.
Only one. And I went back and researched from the original Habeas Corpus Act in England back in the 1600s and all the way through, and what it appears is the habeas corpus is to keep us from being arrested or charged with a crime that's outside of the authority to the government to enact that a law against that.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to read from another case. This one I just ran across fairly recently. I got to find it. There it is. I had, when I wrote the habeas corpus for a friend of mine, actually he's not a friend, I've never met him. In 1997, I testified in the Florida Common Law Court trial on behalf of Toby Brown. Toby Brown was the only one of the 10 or 11 people charged that was acquitted. One person died before trial. The other one person fled and was picked up last year in Arkansas and was taken back to Florida to stand trial. Now, I first did habeas corpus. The article is called "What If I'm Arrested?" Kev. I first did a habeas corpus in, I think it was 1994 or 1995. It had to do with driving without a license, come to think of it. But I hadn't tied down the concept, but I've been kind of studying it on and off for these last 18 years or so. But I always figured I'd use it if I got charged with a crime. But Larry Myers' sister called me and said, can you help Larry? She knew that I was testified in the 97 trial, and I was thinking Larry was a different Larry that I didn't get along with because he called me all kinds of names back then. But then I found out it was this, a different guy, and I agreed to help him, and I filed a habeas corpus, and we got to get Cav to put up habeas corpus 2012. Find habeas corpus 2012, the second article. That first one lists the eight habeas corpus, the one that he's, Cav just posted. Now, I made a mistake a month or so ago when I wrote that habeas corpus 2012. I said we haven't had a habeas corpus for so many years. I was wrong because I was thinking 1858 or whenever that case was, 1878. But then I found one the other day, and this is from 1890. And it's rather interesting in that it kind of vindicates what I believe to be true. And I'm going to read from... Now, habeas corpus can be submitted to one justice, and this was submitted to Justice Miller of the Supreme Court, who answered it. There is really but one question out of the several grounds of relief sought in this case. That is a proper subject of this court. By the Act of Congress approved February 9, 1889, under which defendant is indicted and convicted, it is provided that every person, this is the law, it is provided that every person who shall carnally and unlawfully know any female under the age of 16 years, or who shall be accessory to such carnal and unlawful knowledge before the fact. Now, this is where they set out jurisdiction. In the District of Columbia or other place except the territories over which the United States has exclusive jurisdiction or on any vessel within the admiralty or maritime jurisdiction of the United States and out of the jurisdiction of any state or territory shall be guilty of a felony. Now, I'm going to stop right there. So, this is a federal law, and it only applies to people that come under federal jurisdiction that when that jurisdiction is outside of the jurisdiction of any state or territory. Now, there's two types of territories back then, and this will get into that. One is where they've established a legislative, judicial, and executive branch of government in that state. The other one is... will be addressed in here. It was part of Oklahoma, the area known as the Strip. The offense which the petitioner is here charged is alleged to be in the indictment to have been committed within the part of the Indian Territory, commonly known as Oklahoma, and it is alleged in the indictment that this district of country under the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States and within the jurisdiction of the District of Kansas. The counsel for prisoner contended that this is a territory within the exception of the Act of Congress of 1889, that therefore this act does not apply to this case, and that there being no other act of Congress punishing a party for carnal and unlawful knowledge of a female under the age of 16, the court was without jurisdiction to try or sentence the prisoner. But we think the words, except the territories, have reference exclusively to that system of organized government long existing within the United States by which certain regions of the countries have been erected into civil governments. These governments have an executive, a legislative, and a judicial system. They have the powers which all these departments of government have exercised, which are conferred upon them by the Act of Congress. And their legislative acts are subject to the disapproval of the Congress of the United States. They are not in any sense independent governments. They have no senators in Congress and no representatives in the lower house of that body, except what are called delegates, with the limited functions. yet they exercise nearly all the power of government under what are generally called organic acts passed by Congress, conferring such powers on them. It is this class of government, long known by the name of territories, that the Act of Congress accepts from the operation of the statute, while it extends to all other places over which the United States shall have exclusive jurisdiction. Oklahoma was not of this class of territories. It had no legislative body. It had no government. It had no established or organized system of government for the control of the people within its limits, as the territories of the United States have and have always had. We are therefore of the opinion the objection taken to this point by the counsel for prisoner is unsound. Now, what they said is that Kansas itself was a territory, and the district court was in Kansas. Kansas at that time had a territorial government. They had the executive, legislative, and judicial. So this law did not apply because there's a legislature there. It did apply in Oklahoma, where no such government had been established. So that's a limitation on the jurisdiction of the federal government over people that they have jurisdiction to. Now, that is the most recent. Now, I had trouble finding that. It was not in Find Law. But in searching for habeas corpus, that's the first habeas corpus ad subjacendium, or the most recent habeas corpus ad subjacendium. Now, the other habeas corpuses, there are a lot of habeas corpus cases after 1890, but they deal with different matters of habeas corpus. They're all post-conviction, appeal-type habeas corpuses. Most of them deal with death penalty. And they have nothing to do with overreaching jurisdiction. But the habeas corpus acts all the way through this is what William Blackstone said about habeas corpus. But the great and efficacious writ in all manner of illegal confinement is that of habeas corpus ad subjacendium, directed to the person detaining another and commanding him to produce the body of the prisoner with the day and cause of his caption and detention. Now, back then they brought the body forward, which is what we've been told it means. Nowadays, and in these cases that I find, we don't go through that exercise. It can be handled by attorneys or by paper. It says, this is a high prerogative writ, and therefore by common law issuing out of the court of King's Bench, not only in term time, but also during the vacation, by a fiat for the Chief Justice or any of the judges, and running into all parts of the King's dominions, for the King is at all times entitled to have an account why the liberty of any of his subjects is restrained, whatever that restraint may be inflicted, wherever that may be. Okay, then we go on. This is from Blackstone again. On the other hand, if a probable ground be shown that the party is imprisoned without just cause and therefore hath the right to be delivered, the writ of, and the delivery in this case is release, the writ of habeas corpus then a writ of right, which may not be denied, but ought to be granted to every man that is committed or detained in prison or otherwise restrained, though it be by command of the king, the privy council, or any other. So, if doesn't matter why he's there, if the law is illegal, he's free. Now, then he going on, he says, a doctrine so coeval with the first rudiments of English Constitution and handed down to us from our Saxon ancestors, notwithstanding all the struggles with the Danes and the violence of the Norman conquest, asserted afterwards and confirmed by the conqueror himself and his descendants. And though sometimes a little impaired by the ferocity of the times and the occasional despotism of jealous of or usurping princes. Now, this is back in royal time. So what he's saying is despotism of jealous or usurping princesses, people taking authority they don't have. A remedy the more necessary because the oppression does not always arise from ill nature, but sometimes from the mere inattention of government. Now, if government isn't paying attention to the prohibition imposed by, or the limitations imposed by the Constitution, as we talked about in North Carolina, and they pass a law that's unconstitutional, then habeas corpus should get that person the right. Now, in his case, he wasn't charged with the crime. His remedy was to get into court, and they said he got to go into court. In the case of a law that exceeds the authority of Congress, which I think they did to Larry Myers, they have no authority, they don't have jurisdiction, and therefore it's an overreaching law. They're going beyond the what the law allowed. So he should be released. Now, William Rawl, in A View of the Constitution, written in 1829, talking about habeas corpus, effectually protects the personal liberty of every individual and repeals the injustice of unconstitutional laws or despotic governors. Now, we're getting modern language now. We're not talking about jealous princesses. We're talking about unconstitutional laws or despotic governors. This is in 1829, after our Constitution. And he goes on, if this provision had been omitted, the existing powers under the state governments, none of whom are without it, might be questioned, and a person imprisoned on a mandate of the president or other officer under color of lawful authority derived from the United States might be denied relief. But the judicial authority, whether vested in a state judge or a judge of the United States, is an integral and identified capacity. And if Congress never made any provision for issuing writs of habeas corpus, either the state judges must issue them or the individual be without redress. So without habeas corpus, we have no redress against those despotic governors or unconstitutional laws. So that's what habeas corpus really means. And, you know, people talk about 10th Amendment nullification. How do you nullify a law of Congress? States have been trying that since 1861. Anybody got out any idea how you can nullify? The 10th Amendment was existing in 1861. Anybody have any idea how you can nullify a law of Congress?
It has to be done by the people.
No. How could the people do it? How would they do it? An amendment to the Constitution? Or just a bunch of people saying that law is illegal?
It'd take more than a bunch. It'd take a majority, but they wouldn't pay no attention to it.
Right, but now, to me, the habeas corpus is the way that Larry Myers was charged with, I think, laws that were not within the authority of the Congress to impose upon him as a state citizen. Now, interestingly, during his trial, the U.S. attorney mockingly said, and he has declared himself to be a citizen of Florida, a state citizen. So they confirmed that he's a state citizen in his trial. So there's no question. They agreed. They acquiesced to his statement that he's a state citizen. If he's a state citizen, these laws don't operate on him. So, to me, the only way that you can nullify a law, at least as it applies to people that it doesn't apply to, is by a petition for writ of habeas corpus. Now, I'm going to be going to the United States Supreme Court within the next month and find out if I'm right or wrong. I hope I'm right.
Okay.
But that's we the people. See, it's the separation. It's the distinction. Who is we the people? People that can be state citizens. Now, that's kind of mixed up right now because of the 14th Amendment. And then the conditioning that we've got gone through.
Right, and it'd be a little bit more mixed up over there with the habeas corpus when then the NDAA basically, or whatever, he just did an executive order on, done away with habeas corpus.
Well, I'm kind of waiting for them to send the IRS to me and say, hey, you haven't paid your, Roberts called it a tax?
Yeah.
Right? In that court decision? I think it's interesting. Robert called it a tax. The bill originated in the Senate, and the Constitution requires that any money bill originate in the House of Representatives.
Huh.
Now, there's a case called Ashwander versus United States that applies to habeas corpus. It doesn't really apply to we the people, but who are we? But it's, like I say, it's part of the habeas corpus. Justice Brandeis gave us some insight. In Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority, a 1936 Supreme Court decision. Here's what he said. The court developed for its own governance in the cases confessedly within its jurisdiction. Now, get that. Confessedly within its jurisdiction. A series of rules under which it has avoided passing upon a large part of all the constitutional questions pressed upon it for decision. Get that? They've adopted some rules, the Supreme Court has, that they apply to all questions pressed upon for decision, a constitutional question. They are, one, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of legislation in a friendly, non-adversary proceeding, declining because to decide such a question is legitimate only in the last resort and is a necessity in the determination of real, earnest, and vital controversy between individuals. So what they said is the last resort is determining the constitutionality of a matter before the United States Supreme Court, 1936. Two, the court will not anticipate a question of constitutional law in advance of the necessity of deciding it. It is not the habit of this court to decide questions of constitutional nature unless absolutely necessary to a decision of the case. Now, that's interesting because that must be what Roberts was relying on when he said it is a tax, but nobody said why didn't it initiate in the House of Representatives, so he did not address it. Sneaky trick. Three, the court will not formulate a rule of constitutional law broader than is required by the precise facts to which it is to be applied. So they're going to make it as narrow as possible. The court will not pass upon a constitutional question, although properly presented by the record, if there is also present some other ground upon which the case may be disposed of. So if they can find anything but the Constitution to resolve a case, they will do so. Five, the court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon complaint of one who fails to show that he is injured by its operation. Now, that came up, I think, last year. This lady filed with the United States Supreme Court over something that had happened to her. She'd been arrested in the state, she'd appealed it in the state, and it was denied. She tried to go to the United States Supreme Court. She refiled with the United States Supreme Court after she got in prison, and the Supreme Court, in their decision, in their taking the case, said, now she has been injured by the action, or by the operation. So until she went to prison, she could not file with the Supreme Court. They were applying this rule number five. Now, that's kind of interesting, too, because let's say that you're in Hitler's Germany and you're given an order to do something. The court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon the complaint of one who it's a statutory law, upon the complaint of one who fails to show that he is injured by its operation. So if they order you to shoot that Jew and you don't and say, no, that's unconstitutional, I can't do it, you can't prove you're injured. You can't go to the Supreme Court and say they tried to get me to carry out an unconstitutional law because I have not been injured by it. Number six, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. This is kind of interesting, and I'll give you all a hint. When you get a job, you fill out a W-4, right?
Yeah.
And on that W-4, it says taxpayer identification number, and you dutifully write your Social Security number in there. Then it said how many benefits do you want, or how many dependents do you have, or deductions, whatever they call them. Oh, I have myself, my wife, and two kids. That's four. And then down at the bottom it says, under penalty of perjury, I state that the above is, that I am the taxpayer identified above, and everything above is true and correct. Right? Something like that?
Right.
Okay. The court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. Well, I asked for four deductions, and further, I swore under penalty of perjury that I was a taxpayer.
Okay.
So I have created a relationship with the Internal Revenue Service by filling out a W-4. Right. I have sought a benefit from them. So the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. So my getting those deductions is one of the benefits that I've sought and been granted. Therefore, I can't challenge the statute that says, give me 30% of your money.
Ah, okay.
Okay? Now, I won't go any further than that, but if anybody wants to contact me privately and go a little further on that particular subject, I will be glad to assist you in finding the means of achieving that status whereby you can challenge the constitutionality of the statutes. How's that for a way of putting it?
That's a good way to put it.
Okay. Okay, seventh and final one. When the validity of an act of Congress is drawn in question, or even if a serious doubt of constitutionality is raised, it is a cardinal principle that this court will first ascertain whether a construction of the statute is fairly possible by which the question may be avoided. Now, those are the seven rules.
Okay.
Now, judicial review came about in 1803 when Justice Marshall, the first Supreme Court justice, in Marbury versus Madison said, certainly all of those who framed written constitutions contemplate them as forming the fundamental and paramount law of the nation, and consequently the theory of every such government must be that an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void. So judicial review came when Marshall said that, if it's repugnant to the Constitution, is void. In Ashwander, in 1936, 133 years later, the Supreme Court told us how they get out of evaluating whether it's repugnant to the Constitution or not. Now, if you're not bending over yet, bend over now, because now you know a lot about what's happened to us and why it itches back there. This is our Supreme Court. So, now, let me, nobody's got any questions on this?
I don't see anything. It says,
the only question I see is blowtorches and pliers, question mark. I can't answer that. I don't know what you're talking about. Then you don't get paid.
Reaper says, basically we are cornered legally.
Yes, unless, and I'm trying to find a way out. That's what I'm hoping this habeas corpus will do. Larry Beecraft is reviewing it right now. When he's done, I'm going to go through it one more time. And then it's going to Justice Clarence Thomas, of all people, to be reviewed and see if he will turn Larry Myers back on the street and return his property to him. Now, if you go to Habeas Corpus 2012, which Cav put up there, and we'll put up again just for those that missed it, Exhibit 10 was the Habeas Corpus filed with the Florida Supreme Court. The one that I'm doing, the United States Supreme Court, is almost twice as long at this point because I wasn't strong enough on it. I was trying to be nice, and nice don't pay. So I'm not being nice on the one, the United States Supreme Court. And one of the Negro justices will have to contend with what is presented to him, which includes things about the 14th Amendment.
Well, he'll just have to deal with that. That's what he's a judge here for. He's supposed to be independent. If he's not, he ain't got no business there.
Well, that's true, and it's kind of interesting because when I was, what I found out is the justices are allotted districts. Now, Florida is where this happened, and so it should be filed in Florida, and Thomas is in Florida. Now, I could go to Roberts by going to the United States district, or, you know, I could find another justice, but I got thinking about, do I want to do that or not? And more importantly, wouldn't it be better to put it in Thomas's lap because he's going to be on the spot to be more particular in ruling on it?
Right.
So I don't know. It ends up, and I think the people I discussed it with agree that giving it to Roberts is probably the best justice to give it to, or Thomas.
I would say that'd probably be so, because it's going to put him on the spot, and he's going to have to watch what he does, and he's going to have to answer that very carefully.
Yeah, he is. He's in a serious position. And another thing that in discussing with some of the people that have been helping me review this, and is kind of interesting. The last habeas corpus file that I can find, habeas corpus ad sub judicium, which was difficult to find. Fine Law has John Badal. LexisNexis did not have John Badal 15 years ago when I looked. They may have it now. But electronically, it's easy to lose something.
Right.
And I went specifically to where this should have been, this Henry Lane, the 1891 that I read you that happened in Oklahoma. Could not find it on Fine Law, so I had to go on the internet and look around to find it. And finally, I found it. Now, I don't know why Fine Law doesn't have it. It's a Supreme Court decision, and it should be there. I don't know why they don't have it up there. But see, if they hide these things, we're shit out of luck because we can't find them. However, if 1890 was the last one, let's look at a justice to say he's 70 years old now, Supreme Court justice, roughly 70 years old. That would mean he was born in 1940.
Right.
About then. So he didn't go to law school until 1960,
right.
Roughly. So 1960 was 24 years after the Ashwander decision. So when he got to constitutional law, did they teach him constitutional law? Or did they teach him Ashwander constitutional law?
Ah.
Okay, now let's go to another case that I love. John Badalk versus the United States. John Badalk was an Indian. He was on a reservation. And some deputies of the marshal or something went to his house on a Saturday or Sunday. And John Kilsback was one of them. John Badalk and John Kilsback, interesting names, but... Kilsback didn't get killed. He got killed back. He got killed, by the way. But Kilsback said, "We've got to arrest you and take you in." And John Badalk said, "You tell the marshal or sheriff or whatever he was, that I'll, constable, I don't remember what the title was. You tell him I'll be in there Monday morning." "No, we were told to bring you in now." John Badalk picked up his rifle, shot, and killed John Kilsback. John Kilsback was armed, but never raised his rifle. The courts, the state court, convicted John Badalk of murder. He appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The decision of the United States Supreme Court, and you can find this in self-defense, Cav. So look up self-defense, you'll find it somewhere. The Supreme Court ruled that absent a lawful warrant, John Badalk had every right to protect, even to the point of killing the law enforcement officer. Wow.
Hey, now that's something, you mentioned that and everything, and that's something that I will say that our governor here in Indiana, he just imposed that exact thing that you just said, because they had a deal here where the Congress here had a, or the Senate stuff, had set a rule to where they could come in without warrants. Our governor actually put out an executive order through the governor's office that said if they came into our properties without a warrant, we had the right to protect ourselves any way, means possible, even as far as going to shoot an officer if he did not have a warrant.
But another state recently passed a law that said that you have no right to resist an arrest, even if it's erroneous. So you got two states going two different ways. I can't remember the name of the case, but it was decided by the state Supreme Court that you have no right to resist, even if they entered your place in error. Cross said that's in Ohio, and I was thinking it might have been Ohio.
Well, they tried to hear, and that's when the governor came out with the deal and said, no, you're not going to. You're going to have a warrant to go in.
Because your governor believes in the Constitution, and Ohio governor does not, nor does their Supreme Court.
So. Yeah, but that's the only thing he's done the whole 8 years he's been in office. The rest of the time, he's put the shaft to us.
Okay, now here's where it gets interesting, though. Remember, we got possible two kinds of laws, constitutional ones, John Bad Elk, and there have been subsequent decisions. Now, Shepherds publishes a book that shows when any constitutional or any Supreme Court or any court decision is overturned. When you shepherdize something, you go look at that case and see if it was overturned. Now, John Bad Elk, the last time I looked, had not been overturned. However, there are Supreme Court decisions that have held that, yes, you can get the death penalty for killing a cop if he was in the line of duty, even under color of law. So we've got the Supreme Court has decided two cases. One's constitutional, and the other one, let's call it administrative agency law. Okay. Constitutional administrative agency. A state citizen, U.S. citizen law. That there's two branches of law in this country. And you can find them finding both ways, and one doesn't overturn the other, then there's got to be a fork in the road. There's got to be two sets of laws. Which one applies to us?
Hmm.
So, and that's what I'm pursuing with this habeas corpus of the United States Supreme Court. I think that the way I've written it, they can't get out of it. I think they have no choice but to hear it. I hope I'm right. But it's really an interesting dilemma. I mean, we've got these theories, corporate United States, maritime jurisdiction, admiralty law, and all that. Now, I can go, back to the habeas corpus a little further. In 1946, the Administrative Agencies Act, they said in Congress, on the floor of Congress, that we are creating a fourth branch of government. Now, my Constitution is three branches of government, so how can the legislature create a fourth branch of government? But they admitted they did in 1946.
True.
We have set up, this is the Administrative Procedures Act, and Representative Pat McCarran, Democrat in Nevada, that's what Reed is too, huh? We have set up a fourth order of their tripartite plan of government, which was initiated by the founding fathers of our democracy. They set up the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches. But since that time, we have set up a fourth dimension, if I may so term it, which is now popularly known as administrative in nature. So we have the legislative, the executive, the judicial, and the administrative.
Okay, you do have a question here by Colonel Cross. It says, Gary, if police are unconstitutional, as I believe they are, then how can any law pertaining to submission to police be lawful?
Well, their application, there was a video posted earlier, Cross. I'll get to that. I posted a link earlier. Let me see if I can find it again. It's 6 minutes, and you got to watch this thing. I mean, this is crazy.
And then he says, second, actually, eliminates the need for police. But that would involve the people actually giving a shit about duty.
Well, Cav's ahead of me. He posted our cops constitutional. Now, I have stood since Waco believing, honestly, that the law enforcement in this country has become the standing army the founding fathers feared. Now, our cops constitutional He doesn't quite, he does allude to that, and he doesn't bring up John Vatican there, but he suggests in that article, it was written by a guy that's got a JD, a doctorate of jurisprudence, says that they are the standing army, so they are. Now, that video that I just posted in there, you're going to see sheriff. The guy says, I'm the sheriff, or something like that. I don't know if he was a deputy or not. But he's got body armor, he's got camo, he's got an AR-15, he's got Kevlar helmet. A sheriff is a civil office. Believe it or not, sheriff is not a military office, it's a civil office.
Sure.
So why is he decked out in combat gear?
He sold out.
Now, we hear all this talk, and, you know, Keith Rodgers, I've known Keith for 4 years. I loved the guy. But constitutional sheriffs, one, the extent of any constitution that I'm aware of with regard to sheriffs is it creates the office but does not define it. So does he mean sheriffs that are willing to abide by the Constitution? I assume that's what meant by constitutional sheriffs. Right. So, now let's look at the Constitution. Let's look at the United States Constitution, because otherwise we have to look at 50 constitutions. But most constitutions carry certain things forward. The right to keep and bear arms, though limited in some states. And a good example is Idaho, where their statutes exceed the authority granted by their Constitution in the Declaration of Rights. But most states also require no person shall be held to answer except under presentment or indictment or grand jury or something like that. And then some have reduced that to information. But information defies the concept of the founders. The grand jury is made up of the people. The information is filed by a civil officer. Now, the way it worked back then, though, is the civil officer, under British rule, a civil officer, let's say, for example, Governor Hutchinson, if he issued something that gave the Captain Preston and these soldiers the right to shoot at the crowd, they would have been within their rights. But when they shot at the Boston Massacre, Hutchinson said you had no authority to do that, and they ended up standing trial. Hutchinson was the civil, as is the sheriff. The concept of the military is called posse comitatus. That's when they used to deputize people. The sheriff had a gun on to protect himself, not to kill people. His job is not military, it's civil. But we've seen movies and everything else change the nature of this relationship, especially television series beginning with Cops back in the 70s, the TV program Cops. We've got a whole new picture, and we buy it lock, stock, and barrel that these guys have every right to run around like soldiers. They're going to be issuing them hand grenades pretty soon. They've already issued them flashbacks. They've got tanks. They've got APCs. They've got all kinds of shit. One thing that was astounding about Waco was watching tanks and APCs roll into down 2491, the Loop 2491, down to the Branch Davidian Church. Most of them did not talk about that on CNN or any of those stations. But watching these tanks, watching all these people. The sheriff was deputized, the local police were deputized, the Texas Rangers and the state troopers were deputized. They were all brought into the federal realm. Now, the federal people all had military gear on. The local, the state people, hey, they had civilian clothes on. I mean, they had uniforms, but they didn't have body armor and all the fancy stuff.
Right.
But we have slowly really turned into beyond police state when we're giving them. We're not allowed to. Back then, 200 years ago, you could go down and buy a cannon.
Yeah.
And powder, and ball, and grape, and canister, and everything else. You could go buy them.
Yep.
Now, if it shoots more than one round with a single pull of the trigger, you can't have it. Now, a sheriff never needed a cannon back then. But you don't need a cannon when you've got a machine gun that fires 600 rounds a second or something shit like that. I mean, that's worse than any cannon canister shot. Canister had 300, one thing I read said it had 300 pieces of ball in it. And I guess it depends on the size, because I've seen reference to different size. But basically, he was making a shotgun out of a cannon. It's called a canister. 300 pieces of a ball, probably near a half-inch diameter, I would guess, like the standard shot then. But here you got a machine gun that fires 600 rounds a minute, twice as many in a second, or is that a minute? Whatever the rate of fire is. That's twice as many as the canister did by a single pull of the trigger.
Yep.
What's wrong with this picture? Now, that video I showed on there with the sheriff, my suggestion in another room when I posted that is very simple. That we should have had some quote-unquote camera men up in the trees taking headshots. When are we going to fight back against this bullshit?
That's a good question. I've been asking that question for years now, Gary.
Well, I think that next time people try and... what they were trying to do is stop a foreclosure eviction. Now, interestingly, during the Revolutionary War, as the Committee of Safeties came into being, one thing that they did is they had to set up courts, but they would not handle civil matters. They would handle criminal matters, and they would deal with Tories. But they would not deal with civil matters. So if you owed and you were going to have your house foreclosed on, that was stopped right now. Let's wait and get the shit out of the way, see which government we're going to have before we open up the courts for people to collect debts. We need to do that now in this country. We need to tell them, shut down your courts as far as taking children or houses away from people. Let's get back on track before you do that again. But how are we going to do it? If we're going to do it, we better do it with guns, because they ain't going to listen to demonstrations, they ain't going to listen to signs, and they won't even listen to pitchforks.
No. That's the whole thing right there. And I don't know what's going to come up this week. Don't have any idea. Hearing a lot of rumors and stuff like that. But something's going to have to be done. We can't keep going this way. If we keep going this way, we might as well just go out in the front yard, pull our pants down, and bend over.
Right.
You know, it's just as simple as that. Because we're at the point now where if we don't do something, we're going to totally lose.
I know, and it's a dilemma. You can't get a 500,000 people to march to Washington, because every time they cross the state line, they'd be stopped. If they had guns in the car, they'd be detained. It might be a broken taillight, whatever it is, to keep them from going towards Washington. You can't do it in this day and age. You know, the founding fathers learned how to fight under the conditions they lived under. Now, I wrote something called The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government, which, again, over really 30 years in the Patriot community, 20 active, because the first 10 years was basically the tech stuff. But, you know, just listening, thinking, researching, things like that. The Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government is proposed to give you something to think about. Is it possible that we could get our country back kind of like they did at the Revolution, during the Revolution? Because, you know, towns became one Tory or Whig. Some areas in the Carolinas and in New Jersey and New York, the lines shifted back and forth, but basically it was towns. Now, back then, they had to move across the land or up the rivers or something like that. Now they can jump over us. So rather than having a line between the Whigs and the Tory towns, perhaps we need to look at the Whig towns being a town that decides it wants to become constitutional.
Right. Well, see, that's the way I see it. Everybody thinks, well, let's just go to Washington and get it done with. It's not going to be that simple, like you said. Everything's going to have to be done within your own community. Everything's going to have to move from that point. We're going to have to start small and build our way up, but we're going to have to do it fast.
Okay, that plan that Cav just posted is the final one. It's got some significant changes from any of the earlier versions. That's why it's in PDF, that it is the final version. I've thought of things to put it in since then, but I ain't going to do it.
I've got that on file, so...
Now, Cross, did I answer all your questions? I don't want to scroll all the way back up there. Did we miss anything? Don't see anything. So,
I don't see anything yet. No, huh?
Anyway, you know, there's a point in time. Now, there's another article you need to read, because we all think that really the violence started in April 19, 1775. That's what we think. Well, it's not true. It started a year before then. Well, the potential for violence, I should say. When you've got 10,000 people with their muskets saying, close this courthouse down, you judges all resigned, the potential was there for violence, but the police force wasn't there. The troops were all in Boston, so they couldn't do anything. But the willingness for violence predates April, Lexington and Concord by a year, and that's called the end of the revolution, the beginning of independence, Calf. The end of the revolution, the beginning of independence. And it goes in detail, something that was hidden from our history. It was, you know, they don't want us to know this stuff.
Yeah, Cross said you answered his questions, and he thanks you.
Okay. You're welcome. Yeah, create your own SWAT teams. When we have a show planned when we get YHTOM radio back up, which we're working on, and it's going to be talk about security teams, which I don't like SWAT, special weapons and tactics. No, that sounds too government to me. I don't know if you know the background on that, though. 1967, the Los Angeles Police Department or Sheriff's Department, I don't recall which, began the first SWAT school in this country. And I lost a lot of things in 94 when I was gone and everything got taken out of my office. But I had a copy of a Xerox copy of the original SWAT manual, and it had something rather interesting in it. It said, who might the bad guys be? Well, it could be a disgruntled employee, an ex-convict, an ex-spouse, or even your neighbor. So what he did is, what they did is they created right then in 1957, I didn't dime you out. I didn't mention any names. Oops, I just did, sorry. They created the them or us mentality right then. And that was the beginning of this standing army that's equipped like the army. They have helicopters. Now, I don't doubt that they have machine guns on those helicopters, not sling-mounted or post-mounted 60s, but I'm sure that they've got some pretty heavy weaponry on those helicopters just in case they need it. And I hope I'm not down below them when they decide they need it. But we're going to do a show on security teams to talk and go in depth on what has to be done. But it's one thing that you don't want to ever talk about on the Internet except as an overview. Never on the Internet, email or anything else. Only by personal contact do you ever talk about SWAT teams or anything like that. If you go beyond that, I'll give you a good example. There's a website that everybody knows about that has an Underground Railroad sign-up sheet. And I'm sure that the government has a list of all the names, addresses, and phone numbers of the people that are willing to be conductors or way stations or anything on that Underground Railroad. So if I ever had to go underground, I would not go to anybody that ever, even if they've resigned since then, ever signed up for that list. Because the government, if I go underground, they're going to start where I went underground and start looking around at that list of names of people who agreed to be the underground and stake those places out and wait for Gary Hunt to pop his head up there.
Hey, Gary, talking on that subject, I've got a copy of that.
And I talked to one of the principals on that about it. He agreed with me on the phone on Skype. But then the next day, he put out a broad, you know, out to everybody on the website, come on, join the Underground Railroad. Wait a minute, man. He just agreed with me that it was stupid. Same thing. When you ever talk about SWAT teams or security teams or anything like that, you only talk... this is going to be covered in the security team program when we do it. We had a security team in Florida, and it served its purpose a couple times. We hit somebody from the FBI. I was protected when I came back from Waco. There were a number of things that we managed to achieve. We didn't expect to when we started it. Primarily, it was a self-protection force. It wasn't a militia because we had no intention of going out and serving the community. We were concerned with ourselves. It was very secretive. Our meetings were held in restaurants. Oh, well, yeah, they could bug a restaurant. No, not really, because every time we had a meeting, we met at my office, which was central to everybody. I had my own survey business then. It was fairly central to everybody. And so we'd meet there and then pull out the phone book and decide what restaurant we were going to. So we never knew what restaurant we were going to until meeting time came. Places you can talk, a place you haven't been before or haven't been there in a long time. Out in the woods, in a park with a boombox blaring. But the microphones they have right now are so sensitive, they're unbelievable. And if you're going to talk anything along that line, you better do everything you can to make sure first, and we'll discuss this in that program, that you have are joining with people that you have absolute faith in. And there's things that you have to do to achieve that. And second, that you never communicate in writing or anything else. You only communicate where there is no possibility that you can be heard. When we went into a new restaurant, we watched everybody that came in the door after us. They wouldn't know where we were going until we got there. Anybody that came in after us was suspect. Where they sat, how they looked at us, or anything else was suspect. One time, we got up and walked out before our order got there. We paid the bill and left. No tip, though. But we left because some people came in and we just had doubts. And you have to be extremely cautious when you start venturing into that realm. Look at the Hootery Militia. Look at the Viper Militia. Look at all the four guys in Georgia. You cannot be too careful. If you've got a braggart that says, guess what I know. Now, the security team I'm talking about has been disbanded. Two of the members were executed in Alabama. Two of the others are still in Florida. One's gone to another state, and I'm out here. That was our security team. That was it. But when we disbanded, I was given permission to talk about it because it's a learning experience. But back then, when it existed, I couldn't. Similarly, when we hit Peter Chernoff, Linda Issel, and Peterson and Alex from the FBI, I would never have talked about that except when Peter finally did a plea agreement with the government. The agreement included that anybody involved in transporting or hiding him while he was, they said, kidnapping his son, would not be charged with any crime. So that was in the plea agreement. So that opened that up that I can use that experience then to explain some things. Paul Fata was hidden from the FBI up in Oregon and Washington and Idaho. The government couldn't find him. We can hide people, but it's not an underground railroad. It's when the need arises, you find somebody that you trust, and then you start creating the means to achieve the objective. And I'll tell you about Peter Chernoff. Guy knocks on my office door. We're sitting around drinking some beers. Some friends of mine after work and some of my employees were drinking some beers, maybe smoking some tobacco or something, too. I don't remember. But this guy knocks on the door, and I walked to the door and opened it, and he said, are you Gary Hunt? And I said, yes. And he said, can I talk to you? And I said, yeah. And he said, could you come out here? And he told me his name was Peter Chernoff and that he had come from California, and he had taken his son and his girlfriend to keep her away from the kid's mother, who wanted to put him in a daycare center, Miss Sandy's, that is tied to Michael Aquino, which purportedly has satanic rituals involved with it, and the evidence seems to support that. So anyway, I said, well, come on in, and he said, no, not with them there. So I asked everybody to leave. They left. They brought them in. But he just knocked on my door, but because I'd already started my newspaper, this is before Waco, I'd already started my newspaper, and I talked to some people, other people in California, and done Operation Monarch by, can't think of the guy's name right now, but I'd done, published some articles, about children, child abuse, and not child abuse, but government stealing children, already that he had nowhere else to go, and some people out there felt he could trust me. Well, he found out that he could, and we hid him quite well until he decided to turn himself in. But that's how it's created. It's just you go where you think you're safe, and you keep your eyes open, your ears open. If it looks touchy, you get out. Go somewhere else. But it has to be created then, because people that said, I will do it, man, that don't cut it. They're advertising. And like I told the guy that sponsored that page, what you ought to do is buy everybody a 4x8 sheet of plywood and two signposts, and write on that sign, if you're a fleeing patriot, you can stay here, and put it out on the street. Because everybody's going to know that you're a fleeing, that fleeing patriots are going to come there. So anyway, security teams are, you know, if we don't take the initiative, sooner or later it's going to be too late to even fight back. The best defense is a good offense. As long as the initiative's in the government's hand, they will pick the time and they will pick the place. And you won't know until it's too late. If the patriot community takes the initiative, then we've screwed them up. Their plans become obsolete. They won't work anymore. They got to start all over. They got to figure out what we're doing. Now, true with the plan, I'm sure the government has copies, because I know at least a few people have been asked about the plan earlier on, about the plan for restoration of constitutional government, and I believe one of them's on here right now, that have been asked about it. So we know the government's read it, and I hope they enjoyed it, but the way it functions is it doesn't matter that they know what they're going to do. Because if one town sets up, and just say the town is 1 mile square, that's 4 miles of perimeter. The government's got to cover 4 miles of perimeter. That's a lot of people. They've got to have a command post. They've got to have a supply depot. Logistics. So you've hit their resources. Now, when I went to the Golden Hills Pagesic Reservation in Connecticut, it's a 106-acre reservation. They had 120 cops, state troopers surrounding this place until I wrote an article questioning what it cost to keep 126 guys on duty, and then the New London Day picked up my story and went a little further with it. They got the actual salaries of the people. I'd guessed at the salaries. And the next day, then they dropped it down to, I think, 21 or 22 cops instead of 126. They took over 100 people off the budget line item for that use. But see, they had to cover the whole perimeter, because otherwise, if we could find an outlet, we could have come and gone without them knowing we were coming and going. And interestingly, we could come and go. I could get in a car and drive off the reservation, and they wouldn't stop me, but they still wanted to cover this whole thing. So their MO is to surround the whole thing, like they did at Ruby Ridge. They had people all around that mountain. So you draw their sources down by having a community that says, we're constitutional. Screw you, federal government. I got two communities. I got 8 miles of perimeter. And they've got to have two command posts and two supply points. I get 40 communities doing that, and we've got 160 miles of perimeter and 40 command posts and 40 supply depots. Now, what happens when we start enlarging our area? We incorporate another town, and it's 2 miles away, so all of a sudden we've got a 10-mile perimeter. Now they've got to cover a 10-mile perimeter. That means they have to beef up their manpower, and they've got to provide the logistics for that. And so every time a new community comes online and being constitutional, we're draining their resources. That creates a hell of a problem for the government. Somewhere along the time, they'll pass the breakpoint. They won't be able to deal with it. Now, people have said, well, they'll come in with helicopters and shoot up the town. If they come in and shoot up a town with helicopters and the rest of the country finds out, believe me, hearts and minds will be on our side at that point when the rest of America finds out that they came in with these helicopters just because these people said, we want the Constitution back, we have not shot anybody, but we're not allowing the federal government in here, we're standing firm, and we are a constitutional community, and they came in with, I don't know what they use now, Hueys with rockets and started pounding the town, killing innocent people, women and children. The rest of the country would be outraged at the government. So, you know, the plan is designed to make it impossible for the government to be able to respond to it. The bigger it gets, the smaller they get, the bigger their problem. And it's all over the country. In fact, one of the analogies, somebody said, can you tell me about the plan in a couple sentences? Hell no, it's 40 pages, man, a couple sentences. But then I realized I could. Take a map of the United States. It's all black. That's where tyranny prevails. But here comes a white dot, a small white dot here, and another one over there, and another one over there. And over time, these dots start growing, and they get bigger and bigger, and finally they start joining, just like amoeba growing. And every time they get bigger, it creates more of a problem for government, and eventually, everything but the major cities has turned white. It's only most of the major cities are still black, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. They're still black, but everything around them is white. It just grows. And with it goes the Constitution.
The thing of it is, it's not going to get any better. It's just going to get worse unless we do, like you said, unless enough people gets together. And people don't even have to get together. Just enough groups in different areas stand up and say, okay, that's enough. That's all it's going to take. And it ain't going to take very many. Once they notice that we're not going to put up with it no more, We're going to put a stop to it and everything like that, they're going to back up and regroup. They're going to think things out a little bit more. They're not just going to keep pushing us like they have been.
Well, let me find something real quick. Something somebody said a long time ago that is right on that point. And, you know, we can learn a lot from history, and some of it is applicable and some is not. And we have to be able to discern that which applies properly and that which does not. Okay. And can't find the damn thing.
Well, we're probably going to have to get off.
Talk for a minute, Bravo.
Okay, we're about out of time here.
Take a load off.
So, okay. Gary's looking up some things there. While he's looking up some things, I'm going to say a couple of things that I've heard. And some of it was said on here today and everything. It seems like the Black Panther movement is making their moves in different states, getting around the polling sites like they did 4 years ago, only they're hitting more of them than instead of one or two, they're starting hitting a lot of them. So you guys might be careful of that issue. That could branch into something in your area that you really don't want. Also, I got word today that there has been blue helmets seen around different areas in the United States, around polling areas. So there are is blue helmets going to be out there? That's something we may watch. That could get interesting. This next few days, we're going to have to be very careful. Very careful. Anything could set anything off. We're going to have to watch ourselves. We're going to have to watch our groups, our people. We're going to have to be very protective after our own, because not only the things that's going on with the UN, the Black Panthers and stuff like that, any little group could set something off at any time. So we're going to have to be real careful. That's about the only word that I've been getting this week.
I think that we need to start a group called the White, let's be American, the White Mountain Lion Party. Instead of the Black Panther Party. Or some aggressive animal. Why can't we start something like that?
That
a larger one that is along the lines, not the security teams, not the SWAT teams, but something larger. Why don't the militia start calling themselves the White Mountain Lion or some other aggressive American animal? There aren't that many here, but
because that'd be worse than calling yourself a militia. You would be being a racist then. You would be.
What's this whole program about? We the people.
Right.
Who are we? We have to learn who we are. We have to respect who we are, and we have to go further, and we have to appreciate who we are. This is our country, and it's being taken away a piece at a time.
Very true. Very true.
Maybe I can get Sleepy to post a quote about a mouse. I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. I know of no way of judging the future but by the past. And judging by the past, I wish to know what there has been in the conduct of the, I'm going to replace some words here, Congress for the last 10 years to justify those hopes with which gentlemen have been pleased to solace themselves and the House. Is it the insidious smile with which our petition has been lately received? Trust it not, sir. It will prove a snare to your feet. Suffer not yourselves to be betrayed with a kiss. Ask yourselves how this gracious reception of our petition comports with those warlike preparations which cover our waters and darken our land. That's the SWAT teams, right? The ones you saw in that video. Skipping down, let us not deceive ourselves, sir. These are the implements of war and subjugation, the last argument to which presidents resort. I ask, gentlemen, sir, what means this martial array if his purpose be not to force us to submission? We have petitioned, we have remonstrated, we have supplicated, we have prostrated ourselves before the throne and have implored its interposition to arrest the tyrannical hands of the law enforcement and government agencies. Our petitions have been slighted. Our remonstrances have produced additional violence and insult. Our supplications have been disregarded, and we have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the White House. In vain, after these things, may we indulge the fond hope of peace and reconciliation. There is no longer any room for hope. If we wish to be free, if we mean to preserve inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged, in which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained. We must fight. I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be the next week or the next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed? And when law enforcement guards shall be stationed in every house, shall we gather strength by resolution and inaction? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by lying supinely on our backs and hugging the elusive phantom of hope until our enemies shall have bound us hand and foot? Sir, we are not weak if we make a proper use of those means by which the God of nature hath placed in our power. 3 million people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Then he points out down further, the war is actually begun, and finally what everybody will recognize, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. So you all recognize where that came from now.
Yes.
And that answers your question. We will get weaker. They will get stronger every day, every hour. Look at that sheriff stopping those people to go and object to a lady being removed from her house on a foreclosure. Now, I don't know if it's true or not, but they said she's handicapped or crippled or something like that. I don't know all the details. But I do know what force was put in place to keep these people from going to help that lady.
Mm. Yeah, it's getting more ridiculous every day. More and more every day. something's going to have to be done, and it's we the people that's going to have to do it. We're not left any choice. They haven't left us any choice. We're beyond the point of talking. Talking does not do any good. We're beyond the point of sending paperwork in, talking to our congressman. We're beyond that point. Nobody's listening. They're going to have to start listening. If we're going to save our Constitution and save our country, we've got to save it. Spitting out the window isn't going to do us a bit of good.
No, you whisper first, then you talk in a normal voice, then you start yelling. Now, what comes after yelling? How about gunfire? It's loud enough that they will pay attention to it.
Yeah, because they definitely ain't listening to us now.
Nope.
You know, what? They have not left us any choice. They backed us into the corner. We got nowhere else to go.
Well, let's look at what the Tea Party did. They said 60-some people to Congress, and 40 of those people turned against them and voted for the NDAA and the extension of the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
And the increase in the debt ceiling.
That's because they're all bought and paid for. Once they hit there, they're all good to go until they hit there. And once they hit there, they're bought and paid for. They've got it made. They've got that much money coming in and everything. They can care less what we the people, think.
Right.
They're
all they
want at the top.
They'll say whatever they have to get the job once they get the job. In fact, I used to describe it this way. The guy tells you makes all these promises when he's running for office, and finally you vote him into office, and he starts walking towards Washington, and he looks over his shoulder and says, "Those stupid people."
Yeah. They can care less about us. They're out there for themselves. That's all they're for. They would sell their families down the river if it would advance them. If they would sell their own families down the river, you know damn good and well they'll sell us down the river.
Yeah, since Sleepy's asleep, I've got to find something, so you talk for a while.
Okay, I can do that, because we're going to have to get off here in a few minutes, because Glenn, he's had a rough weekend, and he's probably needing some rest and stuff, so we'll look around. Let's see, what else are we going to talk about? Elections tomorrow.
I'm not
showing up. A couple different reasons why I'm not showing up is I'm not liked that well in the community anyway by certain individuals. Secondly, there's nobody there that I'm interested in voting on, unless they put Donald Duck on the list here this week. That would be the only one out of the politicians I would think about even consider voting for. Most of the people that I would have voted for is dead and gone now. One guy that I would vote for isn't in politics anymore. He knew what was going on. He ducked out first chance he got and quit. So he knew he wasn't making no headway, and he wasn't taking the payoffs they wanted to give him and stuff like that. He just got out. He said he was done. Said he couldn't do no good for the state or for the country, either one, so he just got totally out of politics.
Let's look at voting. Everybody says if you don't vote, you don't have a right to complain. And, you know, that's as stupid an argument as paying your fair share in taxes. Let's look at it. If you don't vote, you don't have a right to complain. Now, on the contrary, if you do vote, you don't have a right to complain. If I play Monopoly, I'm bound by the rules of Monopoly. I got to play by the rules. If I vote, I've got to accept the outcome without complaint, because I agreed when I went in to vote that I was willing to let the winner take the prize.
Right.
So I have no cause to complain if I voted. Now, me, I'm in a state of nature, but I know what my country is. It's the United States of America, created by the Constitution, by the founders, and fought for over 150 years for those principles that we've talked about earlier. We the people, those principles.
Right.
And so I have every right to object to the interlopers who have come in and subverted that Constitution for their own means. If you vote, you give up that right. You're not in a state of nature. You're still in the game of Monopoly, and you're bound by the rules. So if anybody has a right to object, it is me, Now, one step further. I enlisted in the Army. I extended 6 months to go to Vietnam. If I haven't earned the right to object by, one, being in a state of nature, but knowing that this is my country, and two, by having fought for this country when I believe they were telling me the truth, then nobody has a right to object.
Well, besides that, if you sit and you look, we're supposed to vote for people that is for the people, and people that is for the Constitution and everything. And we don't have an elected official out there or a politician out there that fits either one of them bills. So, basically, they are tyrants. And us being United States people, and we the people, should not vote for another tyrant. Because if we do, we're going right against the Constitution to begin with.
Well, you've heard the phrase, voting for the lesser of two evils, haven't you?
Yeah, but what if you got, if all of them's evil and you just...
Well, that's, you know, I got tired of hearing that. Now, let's look at it differently. The Republicans dangle a turd from a string. The Democrats dangle a turd from a string. You're given a choice. Which turd do you want? When you're done, what do you have? You have a turd on a string. That string goes back to people whose names you don't even know. They are the powers. These people in Congress are obliged to the party. Regardless of what their campaign promises are, they will never get any help from the Democratic or the Republican Party in the future if they don't abide by the dictates of the party. The party is controlled by people whose names you will never see. So we don't have a choice. These people are hand-picked. We think we have a choice. Another reason not to vote.
That's very true. But like I said, I'm not going to vote for a tyrant over a tyrant. You know, that'd be like just going in there and say, well, who am I going to vote for? Flip a coin, and whoever wins the coin toss is the one you vote on. That's what it's down to now. That's the choice you've got. Just flip a coin when you go in there if you're going to vote.
It'd be a lot less expensive to just have them toss the coin and see who's going to take the prize, right?
Yeah. It'd be a lot less expensive. It'd be a lot less time off of us, you know, because you got to take time to go down there and vote. You got to do all that kind of stuff. You got to run down there. You got to wait in line just so you can put your mark on a little sheet and everything that they might as well just throw in the trash just as soon as you do it. What's the use of them counting it? They don't know who's going to win.
That's appeasement. If they've thrown you a bone, you grab the bone and devour it. You've got what you asked for. Yeah. A choice.
Yeah, that's all it is. It's a big show. You know, you watch elections on, you see a president elected 4 or 5 different shows a year that they put out. They show this guy get elected, he's a president, and he gets up there and he plays his part and everything like that. Hell, it's the same damn thing. They're just going by the script. It doesn't matter who we vote for. They're going to put who they want to in there, just like in the movie theaters. They put the best actor in there. The one that can bullshit the most, the one that can stand up there and act like he's something. Of course, it kind of screwed up on Obama. He didn't really go by the script. He's kind of stupid, but that's beside the point. I would just about bet today, right now, that nothing's going to change in office. Obama's going to be the president after tomorrow, the same as he is today.
Well, I don't know if you read it, Bravo, but for those in the chat, I posted lying asleep upon the grass.
Hello?
Was aroused by the bite of some animal upon the palm of his hand.
Are you still with
us? He closed his hand suddenly as he woke and found that he had caught a field mouse. As he was examining the little animal who dared to attack him, it unexpectedly bit him a second time and made its escape. Now, fellow citizens, what think you was the reflection upon this trifling circumstance? It was this: that there is no animal, however weak and contemptible, which cannot defend its own liberty if it will only fight for it.
Very true. Very true.
Now, if you're not willing to fight for it, then you're going to get fed to the cat for supper.
That's very true. And we're being fed right now.
So anyway, let's see, are we going to, any more questions? Are we going to close the show now? What?
Yeah, we're going to have to close it up so Glenn can get some sleep. He's had a long weekend. He had his first weekend out in a while, and that was hard on him. So
Well, Glenn, I hope you enjoyed yourself. I guess he's asleep.
Hey, Glenn? No, you got to give him a couple minutes to get to it.
Not minutes, but, you know, more than a few seconds. I'm not, like, on standby, I'm afraid.
Well, you're appreciated wherever you are.
Well, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we thank you a lot, Glenn, and we're going to get out of here so you can get you some rest. I know you're tired, and
I'm just recuperating. I had a great time. It was worth it.
Great times. You usually do have to recuperate.
Yeah, but it was all with Liberty people. I was at the Music City Liberty Fest. I met Bob Murphy and Adam Kokesh and Tatiana Moroz and Jordan Page and Rebel Inc. and a whole bunch of other people, and it was a great time.
That's good.
I wish I'd have been there. I was in a camp area and everything with a summer sleeping bag instead of winter one, like I froze my tail off.
You can have that. I had a good old time myself. I mean, the music was great. The people were great. I mean, it was hundreds and hundreds of liberty-minded people that, you know, people, you know, would just, like, drop their stuff and go off and do something because they knew nobody would filter it because, you know, there wasn't any government employees there.
Put the facts in, too. Now, we've been talking about who we the people are, and remember, that was written as a foundation for the series of articles called Factions, which warrants your attention because it talks about the principal faction, and everybody else, as long as they adhere to the principal faction, is on our side. But keep that in mind. Let's see if Cap can get that up there.
Well, Gary, I think I'm going to go ahead and sign off. Did he?
No, he didn't get it up. There it goes.
There it is.
There.
So I want to thank you, Gary, for coming on tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
When you get that security thing ready, let me know and everything. We'll get you back on. We'll talk about that, or if you got something else you want to talk about, just get in contact with me.
Well, we can do the security team on your show later, but the premier presentation of security team is going to go on YHTOM when we get it back online.
Okay.
With no names mentioned, Smiter.
Okay, I understand that. And
okay.
I want to thank everybody out there tonight. I want to thank you for coming over to the show. Be careful this week. Lots going on. Don't know how things are going to turn out this week. Maybe we'll get some more intel before the week's over with, but I got a feeling something's going to happen. I don't know what, but just one of them gut feelings. I hope it don't, but in fact, I'm praying it don't. You all be safe, take care, and keep close to your people.
Well, that sounds good. We'll go ahead and sign off. Since I've been on the kick, I'm going to play some Rebel Inc. Their show is something to see, by the way, if you ever get the chance. But here you go, Everything That You Hate, and good night, folks.
Thanks.
Your anger and hate. I am the hands that twist your fate. I am your wrongs, very last breath. I am your wrong. I am your White House filled with crooks. I'm the other side of your history books. I am a cure for every disease. And I am what keeps you from chasing your dreams. I am every loss and every gain. And I am the bullet with your fucking name.